From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. All you have to do is look at the magazines at the checkout stand of the grocery store to see just how many mixed messages we're getting about diet and health. It used to be that fat was the bad guy. Now it's carbs. The goal used to be long stretches at the gym. Now it's short bursts of high intensity. James Hamblin says all of this has left us with this perception that there's all this contradictory evidence out there. But Hamblin says there isn't really. Scientists have made some mistakes in the past, but he says the conventional wisdom about food is right. And he says it's not all that complicated. Today in the program, Hamblin is joining us to wade through the noise and explain what we actually know about how to care for our bodies. Join us after the news.
Hey, Radio West listener. We thought you'd want to know that the book we're talking about on today's podcast just happens to be available on Audible. Go to RadioWest.org and you'll find a link included with the show, along with links to IndieBound and Amazon, and any purchases you make through these affiliate partners help support Radio West. Thanks so much.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, James Hamblin is joining us to talk about food and health. He writes about it for The Atlantic magazine. And we asked him to join us to talk about an article he'd written recently about how this obsession for novelty among consumers and in the media had left a false impression about the science of nutrition. When we see articles and headlines that say contradictory things about health, like that butter is good or butter is bad or coffee is good or coffee is bad, it leaves us all feeling like we don't know which study or survey or group of experts to believe. But Hamblin says science doesn't always get it right at first, like the whole low-fat thing, but eventually it does. The answers about eating right, he says, are out there, and they're not that complicated. James Hamblin is a senior editor at The Atlantic, where he writes about behavioral health, nutrition, culture, and preventative medicine. He also hosts the video series called If Our Bodies Could Talk. He has a book by the same name. He joined us from the offices of The Atlantic in Washington, D.C. Hamblin is a medical doctor. He's a radiologist. But at some point early in his career, something about it wasn't fulfilling him. That's where we started our conversation.
Well, I wish that I had some moment of revelation that I could pinpoint, but it was gradual, and I was really reluctant because of the sunk cost of all the education and training I'd done up to that point to give it up. Something about sitting in that dark room, working mainly by myself at a computer for 10 hours a day for the rest of my life, just kind of sucked everything out of me in terms of creativity and happiness and ambition. And I was leaving the hospital and not feeling healthy. So I needed to take some time away. And I got to take a hiatus, during which time I found journalism.
Yeah. But what was the part about radiology that you liked, or you thought you liked, at least initially?
Yeah. There's a lot to like about it. Yeah. It really cool pathology and physics, and it's like you're solving a visuospatial puzzle and giving an answer to people that a lot of areas of medicine can't do. You come into your primary care doctor and you have stomach pain or headaches or so many different things, and you say, we'll try this, come back in 6 weeks, we'll see if you're doing better. And radiology is kind of like, is there appendicitis? Is there a fracture? Is there something we need – what's the clinical decision we need to do right now based on this puzzle that you can solve? And it's very cool. And when you go through textbooks and case conferences, and you see a lot of cool stuff that's happened because of diagnostic imaging. But then on the day-to-day, it ends up feeling so far removed.
So was it just the human connection then that you missed?
I think so. Also, yeah. Just 99% of studies are very, very boring.
Right.
I think it's almost like saying, you know, do you want to do journalism, and you have this sort of, you know, television Hollywood idea of what journalism is going to be like, and then you get stuck on a beat that is just something that you really don't like and isn't your voice, and then and that's what it kind of is. Maybe I would have gotten to a place where I was able to target my interests more and have a better balance, but I didn't stick around.
So I can't tell about – so there was this diversion that you took into comedy sort of, into improv at the Upright Citizens Brigade. And I can't tell if that was just a diversion like, let me sort of do this thing. It'll be fun for a while, or maybe acting would be fun, or maybe stand-up would be fun. Like as a – I mean, others have done it, of course. Did you think about that as a vocation?
Yeah. I never thought that it was really a plausible vocation, except that – so when I was in college, I was in a sketch comedy troupe that took up most of my free time. And one of my friends from the troupe went on to write for Saturday Night Live, and another person who I grew up with, one of my good friends growing up, was writing for Jimmy Fallon. And I was kind of seeing that it was possible to do these things that growing up had not been on my radar. So, I don't know, doing UCB and doing improv was, to me, not really a diversion. It was very true to who I was. It was more – radiology was maybe more not true to me.
Yeah. At what point – was it journalism then that you – when you found journalism that you thought this might be my niche, at least for now?
Yeah. So I got to take that hiatus from residency, and I got a low-level job with The Atlantic, which I was really fortunate to get. And at the time in 2012, it was more of a bloggy internet-type atmosphere where it was kind of voicey and moving really quickly and kind of saying things off the top of your head and getting them published. And I was kind of seeing it as a way to marry interest in comedy and interest in substantive promotion of human health, and it was kind of meeting both of those needs. So it was great.
What did you notice when you first started doing this, or maybe even before, as you were thinking about, you know, getting into journalism? What do you notice generally, I guess, about the way nutrition science, health science, the way those kinds of stories are presented? What was the thing that you were noticing about this kind of journalism, if you were noticing a kind of trend or a type?
Yeah. This has been a element of journalism that's been kind of troubling to a lot of people for a while, which is the need for infotainment, sort of crafting of a story. And I understand that in order to get people involved interested in a large multi-center cohort study about different macronutrients, we need to make it applicable and interesting. And any good story has an arc where something unexpected happens, or something that's challenging the way you think about things, or else why would you want to listen to it? So there are good and noble ways to shape a story that are necessary and are keeping the reader or listener in mind. And then there are also, you know, imperatives where people feel the need to make the story more entertaining than it kind of is justified to be. And I think that happens particularly in science where – you know, the conventional wisdom is just not being upended daily. That's not how science happens.
But we think it does. We think there's always something new that's going to – right? I mean, that seems to be the – I mean, this is the impression that you're challenging in your latest piece in The Atlantic, that the reason something is popular isn't because of the quality of it or the accuracy of it, but we're drawn to it because there's – we have this obsession with novelty.
Yeah. I think that if something isn't challenging your view of the world, it's much less interesting. Yeah. And with health and science that generally kind of moves forward like this amoeba, and there are occasionally discoveries that turn everything on their head. Mm-hmm. And that's an amazing story when it does happen. But it's just you kind of almost get the impression that it's happening daily if you just read general interest news media, and the internet has kind of only exacerbated the need for for that sensation of newness, where things feel old when they're an hour old. It's a problem because ultimately, day after day, the effect is you think, oh, this is just constantly happening. Mm-hmm. Everything is always getting upended, so I might as well just believe in nothing and follow whatever the celebrity diet book or whatever the fad that they're selling to me. Whoever can be most persuasive with their argument must be right. And that's, you know, that leaves us worse off than if you know, we didn't have all these daily news stories.
I mean, if you look at just I'm trying to think of some of the headlines that I've seen over the last three or four years, you know, and I think people have the sense that sometimes they're told breakfast is crucial, and then now skip breakfast. Cardio is key. No, cardio is not all that important. Strength training is the thing. Forget weights, focus on endurance. No, it's not about endurance. It's about quick bursts. I mean, people are really, they really feel confused. And I guess that's the thing you're talking about. At the end, then they're like, well, I don't know if I trust anyone.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's a serious problem. So how do you thread this needle of keeping, keeping people informed of the latest updates to what we currently know, and to show that that's an interesting and important new study to know about, but that it doesn't negate everything that has come before it. It's kind of just building on that.
Yeah.
So, and especially usually you're given just a few minutes on the radio or a very short article, and to communicating that nuance is. As a consumer of health, it's empowering to know that this stuff isn't constantly changing, yeah. And that you can kind of take any new given study with a grain of salt, and it's not going to change your life.
Yeah.
But it's a problem when people start to think that it should.
It's James Hamblin. He's a senior editor at The Atlantic Magazine, where he writes about health. We'll take a break and come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West. On KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're talking with James Hamblin about nutrition and health. And Hamblin says eating right isn't all that complicated. We just sometimes make it complicated. So there's this massive worldwide study that you've talked about, written about, that was released this month. More than 135,000 people, 18 different countries, 5 continents. And it's a decent study. I mean, it spanned 7 years, so pretty comprehensive as things go, published in The Lancet. So, you know, seemed legit. It's this and I wanted to talk about this. It's the Prospective Urban-Rural Epidemiology Study, PURE. Talk a little bit about what the study says.
Sure.
Interesting. Everyone is. Well, I guess the headlines were telling us that this was changing conventional wisdom. Your take on it was that, well, not really. So let's talk about what was in the study and what you saw in the study compared to the way the study was, I guess, conveyed to everyone else.
Sure. So it's a huge, long-term prospective cohort study, which means you take people at baseline and then follow them up years later to see what their outcomes were, which is one of, if not the most valid ways to study nutrition, because you can keep it relatively controlled and you can actually monitor for whatever outcomes you want to look for, whether it be cancer, heart disease, stroke. And so they did all that, and they did it with a ton of people in many different countries. And the top line takeaway for a lot of people was then that people who had diets higher in carbohydrates tended to have higher rates of mortality during the study period than people who had diets higher in fat.
Right.
So that's true. But it's a very interesting way to – you can slice and dice the data a lot of different ways. But when you start lumping everything in together as carbohydrates, when you're talking about high carb, low carb, mm-hmm. That immediately raises alarm bells for me, because we know that if you have a diet that's – you're eating tons of salad and fresh fruits and vegetables and whole grains and beans, there you are eating what the healthiest, longest-lived people in the world eat.
Right.
And if you have a diet that is mostly Skittles and white bread, also a high-carb diet, you are putting yourself at the highest possible risk for metabolic syndrome, for obesity, diabetes. So right there, high carb alone tells me hardly anything. And the overall patterns of when you broke it down further and looked at what people actually ate, where were these people who had the most dangerous high carb diets located? They were in places where it was harder to get fats and proteins, people eating a lot of white rice, risking malnourishment from not having these fresh fruits and vegetables and the things that would be good carbohydrates. So it didn't really add up to me that the takeaway should be that carbohydrates are bad. I don't think anyone would say that. But it does challenge the notion that fat is bad, which was, you know, low fat was a trend in the 90s mm-hmm. in the U.S. and everyone thought they needed to eat Snackwells and other low fat packaged products and that they'd be healthy then. But that's been something that's been turned over. We've moved away from again and again in past decades. So to think that fat is bad is the conventional wisdom at the moment, I think, doesn't really have a finger on the pulse of what people think.
But are you still seeing – it seems to me like I still hear an incredible reticence about about telling people that it's okay to eat healthy fat, that there's a kind of reluctance by – and for obvious reasons, I suppose, but you don't think you're hearing it as much as you used to, I guess.
Maybe I only talk to scientists and doctors, or I talk to too many scientists and doctors, but I don't know anyone who's recommending that. So there's some dispute over saturated fat,
yeah,
and whether there should be limits on that. But no one who's saying that you shouldn't be eating mono and polyunsaturated fats. And few people who are saying the question on saturated fat tends to be more about, is the idea of a guideline with a specific number something that makes people healthier or not? Because saturated fat in the popular imagination has come to mean, saturated fat is good. I'm going to just eat pizza and cheeseburgers and whatever else.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
It's associated with bad foods. But there are saturated fats in good foods, and just because there's no limit on it doesn't mean you should pursue it endlessly. But some people think that having some limit on it is still prudent. And so there is still a limit on it, according to the World Health Organization and the U.S. dietary guidelines. But a lot of people think that should be removed. A very interesting area, but it's not upending wisdom that was conventional within the last.
Well, let me ask you this. So I just read something from the entrepreneur Tim Ferriss, and he has this book called The 4-Hour Body. It's this diet that he follows called the slow carb diet. And he says in it, he says, except on your cheat day, that people should avoid fruit, that basically that's a bad idea. It's just sugar. It's basically fructose. I mean, it has some vitamins in it, of course, and it has some fiber, but that humans didn't evolve with a, you know, consistent access to fruit. So they should probably rethink having fruit on a regular basis. Where do you see that idea? Because that, the idea of a slow carb kind of diet, and you get into this dispute about the role of carbs on a regular basis, or at least, you know, high in sugar kinds of carbs. I mean, how do you talk about that when you hear something like that?
I'd say that stories like that are just really seductive because they can so quickly, it's pseudoscience. It makes sense to someone who has a basic level of literacy, but it actually is not something that is proven in the world. So this is not my line, but David Katz, who's at the Griffin Hospital in Connecticut, he writes a lot about diet, and he says, you know, show me one person who is obese from eating too much fruit. And that's not going to include, you know, juice, which we know people should be eating in very limited quantities. But it's to eat 20 apples, you simply fill up on the fiber.
Right.
Or you run out of money. You're not going to, you know, you maybe could eat a ton of raspberries or something and get a lot of sugar. But basically, we limit ourselves in that. I don't see the utility in telling someone not to do that. And I think that if you look at, again, at the healthy populations of the world, they do eat a lot of fresh fruits and vegetables. So it's kind of misdirection. And potentially the problem is that a lot of people only want to keep a couple rules in their head, in the same way that I don't know much about auto mechanics or finance, and I kind of like having a mechanic tell me what I should do with my car.
Yeah.
And some friend who knows more about mortgages tell me about what is a good mortgage. And most people think that way about food and aren't biohackers like Tim Ferriss. So if one of those rules is avoid fruits and you're taking up valuable space, valuable real estate in the mind directive compartment.
This is something that you you write about, that this idea of not having good, high quality, randomized, controlled clinical trials to make a definitive statement about some of this stuff. Like, we don't have enough of, at least some people complain about it. You quote Stephen Nissen in your most recent Atlantic piece. He's the head of cardiology at the Cleveland Clinic, who was kind of bemoaning the lack of these kinds of trials. And he mentioned without them, you know, without these good randomized controlled clinical trials, which are probably impossible to actually get. I mean, they're really difficult. You're left with what he describes as this cult-like collection of advocates who offer all of these contradicting ideas. Talk a little bit about that. Why is it impossible for us to find trials to say something definitive about this stuff?
Yeah. Well, because ideally you want to look at lifelong outcomes, right? So we do have randomized trials where you can say, okay, we're going to have people add nuts to their diet for a month and then measure their cholesterol levels or measure their body fat percentage a few months later or in the subsequent month. That's something you can do. You're limited by time. You're limited by number of people. You're probably only going to get at most a few hundred, maybe low thousands of people to do that. But then making the leap to say, okay, does that actually improve your life? Does that make people live longer, have less disease, or is that not meaningful? In order to do that, you need to follow people for longer and look at all the other things in their diet that could be changing during that period and also possibly interacting or being replaced by whatever that trial has introduced to their diet. So ideally, you want to follow someone through their whole life and know the circumstances in which they were born and how active they are and what their level of education is and what their social circles are like and then when they get diseases and what level of access to healthcare they have. And you want to do this for tons and tons of people and monitor everything that they're eating. So you'd end up having to have, you know, like I've sort of described before, like islands of babies who were born and the islands are identical, right, and they're all their parents have agreed that their entire life they're going to follow either a Mediterranean diet or a paleo diet or a vegan diet, and then see how these islands, large islands ideally, 100,000 on each island, see how their lives are and socially keep everything the same. Anyway, it's completely absurd and crazy. But what we do have is sort of these natural experiments that mimic that pretty closely. You can look at the lifestyles of people in different areas of the globe throughout history and see who's healthy and who's dying of what, and try to control, you know, immigration patterns. Let us kind of control for hereditary influences in a way that you could say, okay, well, when these people do move to the U.S. and start eating an American diet, do they have lower or higher mortality? What was the effect of the diet where they came from? So this is all to say that, yeah, epidemiology like this peer study is extremely valuable. And when people say that the only way to prove something is with a randomized control trial, that only introduces more like chaos and confusion into the picture.
Yeah. You say you don't think eating right, eating well, is all that complicated, at least conceptually speaking. It's not really that tough. Yeah?
Yeah, conceptually. I know that a lot of people have barriers to access and lack of education or have been confused by these same patterns that we're talking about. But mainly, if you eat – it's hard to even put it in words, because as soon as you start making directives, like if you tell people to eat vegetables – and I've sat in on and moderated sort of consensus conferences where experts try to put this into words exactly like what people should be eating. And if you say fresh vegetables, someone will raise their hand and say, well, couldn't they be frozen? Couldn't they be canned? I mean, is there really evidence, and does it need to be a diverse array of vegetables? What if, you know, should we say people should eat a variety of colors of vegetables? And no, there's really not evidence for that. But basically, minimally processed, plant-based diet, lots of whole grains, fruits, vegetables, nuts, seeds, legumes. You see that this is across history, throughout history around the globe, what healthy, long-lived people tend to eat.
James Hamblin, he's a senior editor at The Atlantic magazine. He is a host of a web series called If Our Bodies Could Talk. We'll take another break and come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Back now to our conversation with James Hamblin. He's a senior editor at The Atlantic magazine, where he writes about behavioral health, nutrition, culture, and preventative medicine. What are you worried about most as a doctor now, as a journalist, and as you look at the way people are eating, or our cultural behaviors, or the things we know or maybe don't know? Does something come to the top when you sort of fret about our health?
I think about the health impacts of technology and climate change a lot. Yeah. Probably climate change is at the top of mind right now. And it's interestingly something that we don't think about in terms of our food system and our dietary choices and the role that they play in sustainability. Because people tend to talk only about health outcomes when it comes to what's a prudent diet for me.
Yeah.
I wrote recently about what would happen if everyone ate beans instead of beef.
Yeah.
And the climate impact of that would potentially be huge. It would limit deforestation, conserve water, greenhouse gas emissions. The U.S. could go a long way toward meeting the 2020 emissions goals that were set by President Obama. With just that one change, people don't have to become vegan.
Yeah.
So I think that's something that a lot of people could think a lot more about. And it also can be empowering at a time when you have a government that is emphatically not interested in greenhouse gas emissions and addressing climate change head on.
Yeah.
And that there are things people can do for themselves. And that empowerment has health benefits itself.
I wanted to ask you about almonds, because you wrote about this too. You say there's this strong case to be made that almonds, you know, are practically the single best food a person could eat. And you could go down the list of reasons why. But you point out that lost in the coverage of the benefits is the environmental impact that you've seen. And there's a pretty significant one.
Yeah, that dates. That was a couple years ago, and during the kind of the peak of drought in California, yeah. and a lot of our almonds come from there. A lot of American almonds come from California, and that they are a water-intensive crop. And I don't mean to be prescriptive about where people should draw a line between their own health benefits and what is environmentally sustainable. Fortunately, we're in a country where a lot of people have access to lots of different healthy alternatives. You could eat fewer almonds and still have a very healthy diet. And it was at least interesting to consider that connection in a way that a lot of people don't think, oh, well, there's a drought in California. I shouldn't be eating all the almonds right now.
You say in that article, you said increasingly we're going to have to think beyond nutrition to, you know, where our food is coming from. Are you seeing that now? Obviously, we're thinking a lot about climate change, given Irma, given Harvey. Are we thinking about this stuff more, do you think, as we see these changes?
I think it's still a blind spot. Yeah. I think people think about climate change and they think about the energy grid and transportation and not so much about diet. Whereas industrial agriculture, largely animal agriculture, is just a huge contributor that has been out of discussions for a lot of interesting reasons, but something that there's not likely going to be federal policy changes on, and certainly not a global consensus on everyone needing to do something. So starting to see people's awareness raise maybe a bit, but I think a lot of people are sort of subject to the fallacy that you either need to become vegan or there's nothing you can do.
Yeah. What's the question you get asked the most, do you think? Or series of questions?
Why aren't you practicing medicine? you mean about health and science? Most people a lot of questions about diet, a lot of questions about kids and screens and mm-hmm. personal technology habits. And then... different exercise trends and how much do I really need to be doing and is sitting killing me? Because everyone's sitting and staring at screens now.
But you worry about that. I mean, you've written about that.
Oh,
a lot.
Yeah. Yeah. That is something you keep seeing in studies is that the going and working out for 20 minutes, even an hour a day, does not negate the health impacts of sitting all day of a generally sedentary lifestyle, and that again comes from epidemiology. You don't actually like confine people to chairs every single day for decades, but you look at people who live in ambulatory situations in small communities where they just walk around a lot or just have jobs that require them to be moving around, and they're just simply better off than you know the desk worker who happens to do CrossFit a couple times a week.
Hmm. I guess I thought you were going to say I mostly get asked about legalizing marijuana.
That seems to have trailed off. I think people are kind of accepting that as either like an inevitability that's happening in enough places mm-hmm. and there's just not this fear around marijuana that there was as a life-ruining substance like in the 80s. So yeah, not so many questions.
Yeah, but I wonder. But I've also seen you've been writing about this too, and you've written about, for example, how here in the U.S., you write about how in a lot of states, people basically woke up one morning and marijuana was legal, and you've compared that to the way the Canadians are doing it, which is they're moving more deliberately, more cautiously, people more willing to talk about safety impacts and those kinds of things. And I wonder, what do you make of that? Is that a cultural difference? And what are you seeing in that way?
Yeah. I've interviewed a good number of people who are anti-legalization. And the argument tends to be that look what's happened with the food industry in the United States. You know, you'd think that we could have a healthy relationship to sugar, that you would allow, you know, people would just say, okay, well, I'll have candy occasionally. Yeah. But no, we have a terrible epidemic of metabolic disease that is largely caused by the food industry. And look at the tobacco industry and how it marketed to kids and got half of Americans or so hooked on cigarettes in the mid-century, even when they knew that it was dangerous. How do we prevent something like that, given our preference for the economic advancement of industry in this country? How do we expect that that's not going to happen with marijuana, where you're going to have cannabis laced everything everywhere and ads to kids and it's just going to have all these consequences that we can't predict once money becomes a factor.
Right.
And that's interesting and something I'd be wary of, because we don't really have data on what would happen, like, you know, specifically the American society when it has access to a drug which can be then packaged and concentrated and sold 1,000 different ways. Mm-hmm. What will happen? And I think that's a reasonable concern.
Yeah,
I think there are reasonable concerns to that. So ideally, from a health safety perspective, I think it'd be ideal to roll it out in a way that would have it not repeat the mistakes of tobacco and sugar. And I understand that.
But this sort of gets to the thing that you were talking about earlier. It's like, we have this mentality. It's either paleo or vegan. We can't seem to manage the way in between for some reason.
Yeah. So that gets to identities. You know, mm-hmm. I think people are very isolated right now. Communities are... community and community civic organizations, not what they used to be. A lot of people feel lonely and isolated and are looking for ways to understand themselves. And maybe this isn't – they're not consciously saying, yes, this is it. The paleo CrossFit community will be my salvation.
Yeah.
But it is somehow filling this void of who I am and what I do and how I eat and how I work out and who I socialize with. In subtler ways, probably, that then make it harder to compromise. And then when you change what you eat, you're kind of changing who you think you are.
Yeah.
And that's a bigger change than just deciding to order something different.
I wanted to ask you about – you had written about said something not where medicine you didn't think was so good at allocating resources. That you've said this, you said that we don't think enough about how to take limited resources and just give those quality of life years to as many people as possible. What did you mean by that? I wanted to hear you out on that.
It would be easy to misspeak on this subject as soon as you talk about any idea of doling out quality life years to people, then you're quickly in the area of what happened with Obama and death panels. Mm-hmm. Ethically, yeah, a long discussion, but basically we tend to think mostly about extending life at any cost in this country.
Yeah.
And I think most people agree that if we were to focus more on quality life years rather than absolute number of life years, you ask anyone, not anyone, most people, you know, would you rather live a long life where you were just unhappy and sick and bedbound, or would you rather live a shorter life where you were healthy and productive and happy? People choose the latter. And so how do we create a system without feeling like we're rationing or ending people's lives prematurely, mm-hmm. certainly off the table, how do you then focus on what most people agree that they want, which is quality life years? And I don't have a perfect answer to that.
No, well, but I'm not sure anyone does at this point. I mean, there's been some good, it seems to me, some good writing about, Atul Gawande writes about this, you know.
Yeah.
When you make these decisions, or as a doctor, how you help people make these decisions, especially if it's your mom and she's 89 and the question is whether to have this invasive surgical procedure. Or just, you know, what do you say to these kids, you know, who are there
right.
talking to you? And like, have you heard any good answers to that yet?
Oh, yeah. A lot of people have good philosophies on that. And I think it often comes down to that one-on-one conversation mm-hmm. with the doctor who you know and trust and has been your doctor for a long time and who can talk to you and your family. And ideally, you've talked to your family about this before a time when you are sick and maybe not lucid and are able to talk about what you want to prioritize and to frame the discussion not as would you like to live or die, but what do you want to prioritize? And you have to accept that you're not going to have everything. You're not going to have a long, healthy life. Do you want to prioritize comfort or longevity? More time or more quality time?
Yeah.
And you kind of force the decision with you, with your loved ones during a time when the stakes are low and you can help to fully understand someone's, you know, perspective on this mm-hmm. and then designate people who can speak for you when you won't be able to.
Yeah.
And that also just takes the burden off of them, because when you put other people in that situation and they don't know what you would want, it becomes almost impossible for them to say – just based on our culture, that the choice should be made to pursue comfort over longevity. The people, the proxies will choose longevity because they don't want to feel that they have resulted in someone else's death.
Yeah.
But that leads to people dying ways they didn't want to die and enduring uncomfortable, painful months and years of treatment that they themselves might not have wanted. Well, this got serious fast.
Yeah. Well, let's talk about coffee then. right?
Okay.
Is there a limit for the amount of coffee that we should drink? You wrote a piece on this, and I think it's interesting, and a lot of people are waiting with bated breath to hear what you're doing.
Yeah. Well, that's another great example of epidemiology and its role in specific foods. There was a group recently reviewed all the studies that have been done over decades looking at longevity and long-term health outcomes and people's coffee intake. And they were looking to validate the rule that 4 cups of coffee were safe.
Mm-hmm.
And they found that they were. They did not negatively impact people's health. 4 cups in the old school diner sense, not 4 huge Starbucks things.
Right, not 4 ventis, for example.
Yeah, which is probably closer to 1.5 or maybe 2 ventis.
Yeah.
If that.
Yeah.
But that coffee has all kinds of effects as a stimulant that are different from other foods. So it might motivate you to get out and exercise or exercise harder or go be social because you're meeting people for coffee or because it livens up the conversation.
Mm-hmm.
And so there are things there culturally and just in terms of it being a drug which make it harder to predict than something like studying the effects of almonds on people's
right.
longevity.
Right.
But I drink it.
Yeah. For health or just because –
Yeah. I don't do it thinking that it's going to make me healthier or live longer.
Yeah.
That is the kind of the consensus of all the experts I've talked to is they would not recommend anyone pick up coffee as a health measure. But if you enjoy it and you are doing it already, et cetera, also would not give it up. Giving it up.
What's the system in our bodies right now do you think that we don't understand very well? Is there one?
Oh, yeah. I think it's not really the microbiome, the intestinal biome, the trillions of organisms that outnumber human cells inside of us and on us, we are just so barely scratching the surface of how to manipulate that, or how that changes with the changes in our lifestyles and diets that might be promoting health, and what that relationship might be. I don't see us really understanding that in any comprehensive way during my lifetime, but maybe we will.
You were writing about the immune system, and this is one thing you said about it. You said we used to think of the immune system as this, you know, this force that was defending us, but now you say we kind of understand it as something, in fact, that isn't just defending us, but interacting with the, you know, the quote unquote other. Which I have to say, yeah, I'd never really thought about it in that sense, but that's kind of how it works.
Yeah, the whole discovery of the human microbiome and just how vast it is has really changed the self-other distinction that shaped so much of health and public health for the beginning of the 20th century, and the idea of us trying to just isolate and disinfect and douse ourselves in antibiotics. And, you know, a lot of good was done with that model. But now many people have autoimmune diseases that we didn't even realize were related to the immune system, seem to be autoimmune. Ourselves are attacking us, so self is not necessarily good. And meanwhile, other is becoming very good. People are trying to take probiotics and introduce other types of microbes into their guts. So the whole self-other thing is blurring in really interesting ways right now.
I wanted to ask you finally, come back around to something we were mentioning earlier, and that it's not all that complicated. One of the things that you've talked about is what really matters are those day-to-day decisions. I wanted you to say something about that finally. And I'm wondering if that's something that you do in your work, is that, you know, there are these big, complicated ethical questions and you know, a lot of these big, high-profile disputes and things like that. But are we paying enough attention to the day-to-day stuff, do you think?
Yeah. Yeah, I think about that a lot, because it's easy to get wrapped up in the huge, high-level discussions. What should everyone be eating? What are the macronutrients that are really causing diseases? And also to forget that most people don't care about physiology and science at that level, and are really interested in feeding themselves and how they should be exercising and how to get better sleep and how to have better relationships. And most of that sort of media is dominated by kind of ascientific lifestyle wellness guru type things. So how do you apply, how do you make things a little more accessible and usable without oversimplifying and telling people that they just need to avoid gluten and they will not get any diseases ever? So how do you give quick, usable, memorable information that gets at these bigger ideas? So that's kind of, yeah, what I'm constantly trying to think of ways to do.
That's James Hamblin. He's a former radiologist and a senior editor at The Atlantic Magazine. He's also the host of a video series and the author of a book, both of which are called If Our Bodies Could Talk. You can find links about all of that on our website, radiowest.org. Hamblin joined us from the offices of The Atlantic in Washington, D.C. Radio West is a production of KUER News. We had technical direction from Michael Havey. The program produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.